it's a whole story on its own, like getting having these kind of near death experiences, going through surgeries, and like you know you have internal bleeding and like all these things that you sometimes only hear like in magazines, books, and all of a sudden it's happening to you, and you're like, is this the end of this wild ride?
Hello and welcome to the Duffel Shuffle. I'm Adrian Ballinger, and we're here to discuss the world of climbing and skiing in all its forms through the eyes of mountain guides.
And I'm Sam Kiekeffer. In each episode, we'll unpack exhilarating stories, share invaluable insights, and get up close and personal with some of the most experienced and passionate guides and athletes in the industry.
Whether you're a seasoned alpinist or a weekend warrior, the Duffel Shuffle is your ticket to the thrilling world of climbing, skiing, and mountaineering. Join us.
All right, Adrian,
episode two. We just had an awesome interview with Topo Mena. Actually, you had an awesome interview with Topo Mena. I had an hour and a half of technology issues.
Yeah,
I'm sure it was an awesome conversation.
Are you in a base camp somewhere, very remote with terrible internet?
Unfortunately, I'm sitting at home with very good internet and still having technological difficulties. So we're going to totally nail it when you are in a base camp somewhere. We're just working out the kinks, right?
That's actually exactly what I was thinking. That like we do have this goal of recording episodes in some really difficult places, potentially high altitude with limited connectivity. And so, yeah, I feel like today was just like sort of a dry run for all of that. It was about as bad as it can possibly get. And I can't wait, but I think it was a great episode. So I can't wait to hear what it sounds like. Good luck with editing.
You know
that Sam is the editor, creator. He is the one who makes the magic happen. I just, sit here on my screen with my Peloton behind me.
It is what it is, right? I mean, at least we still had a conversation and we're learning. So it's March 21st. What are you up to?
Yeah, March 21st, it's Everest. I hate to spend so much time talking about Everest, but actually I don't at all because I love it so much. And it is just my reality. So I've been home a week now from Switzerland. I've been trying to get out and ski. But more than that, I've been trying to wrap my head around what the last 4 weeks before leaving home to guide Mount Everest looks like. And for me, that's been like trying to spend loads of time with family and Arrow. Like I'm already having those pangs of how much I'm going to miss him. And like, it's weird, but cool. but like, yeah, normally when I go away on big trips, like I'm someone who compartmentalizes pretty well. And so like, I don't tend to miss things. sorry, Emily. No, of course I miss Emily. Come on. But it's just like, yeah, no, I could turn off and be like, oh, I'm not doing that. Now I'm doing this. And yet leading up, it just feels like it's going to be more difficult to do now. So that's interesting. Then I'm trying to spend time walking uphill. The importance of just walking uphill slowly to being successful on Mount Everest is so huge. But unfortunately, walking uphill slowly takes a lot of time. It's not the easiest workout to squeeze in. And then my completely chaotic little business, Alpenglow Expeditions, which I love so much. I also want to spend like every minute of every day in that office in the chaos and hopefully adding to reducing the chaos, not increasing it. But I think the team might tell me that my effect is more in one direction than the other, and that's okay. So that's what I've been doing. What have you been doing?
You know, it's funny you talk about walking uphill slowly. I'm heading off for my ski exam in the end of April, similar to when you're heading to Everest. So I'm kind of in training mode myself, and walking uphill slowly, putting in big days on the skin track is very time intensive, and it doesn't work with being a new father. So I've taken to Nordic skiing. It's like a more fun version of running for me. It's actually quite difficult and sometimes scary when it's like firm conditions and you're going downhill at like what seems to be really fast, although it's probably like 8 miles an hour. But yeah, it's my way of like getting fitness and getting out and being active in a more efficient manner. So you should give it a try.
I really need to. I mean, you know, I actually live a block from the Nordic Center, and I don't Nordic ski. It's a big goal of mine. In this next life, you know, I have a feeling I'm going to be spending a lot more time around here in North Lake Tahoe once the kiddo goes to school, and I'm excited to begin my Nordic skiing career. So maybe you can teach me some lessons.
I won't teach you, but I will certainly go out with you.
Okay, well, before we dive into the news, just for context, you mentioned your ski exam. That sounds funny. Is that like a college exam? Like, tell people what that means and what the context is.
Yeah, so you are a fully certified mountain guide, IFMGA, and I'm a mountain guide in training, essentially, going through these programs. So in the ski discipline, the exam is the final of four courses that you have to take, along with avalanche courses and many different objectives for your resume in the process. But the ski exam is the culmination of that. And in the end of April, I'll be heading to the North Cascades for 8 days of examination. So there's a rescue drill, a crevasse rescue drill that we're examined on, and it's timed. And then other than that, it's, well, you've done it, so you could probably tell me better. But my understanding is it's 8 days of being evaluated, how you travel in the mountains and how you manage a group in the mountains. So moving on glaciers, moving in steep technical terrain, using ropes, although when you're using a rope, you're not actually skiing. So I try not to pull the rope out that much. Yeah. So, you know, for me, my fitness is at a point where I think I would be fine going to the exam, but I'd love to take that factor out of it completely and just be so ready from a fitness standpoint that I can think about everything else and not have to worry about recovery, fitness, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, at some point we should do a full episode on sort of what AMGA, the American Mountain Guides Association, or the IFMGA certification means to mountain guides, how you get it, why it's important, why we're both such big believers in it. I'm kind of hoping I can have my Black Diamond teammate, Angela House, who I think is president of the AMGA right now, and also one of the, you know, technical team and instructors. Hopefully we can get her on and talk much more deeply about this, because it is so important to me and to Alpenglow Expeditions and to, I think, professionalizing mountain guiding in the United States and around the world. And professionalizing mountain guiding has a huge benefit, obviously, to clients. It also, I believe, has a huge benefit to mountain guides, as we think of it more as like a lifelong career and the importance of education in the early stages of that. And the fact that certification is just a kicking off point. Like when you finish, it's like you graduated school, like you're actually just at the beginning of your mountain career, even though you've also been guiding for years. So, stay tuned for a future episode, I guess, because otherwise I'll talk in the next 30 minutes. But I'm excited to hear about your exam and how it goes. My exams were exceedingly challenging. I learned so much. Now looking back at them, I'm really passionately happy about them. But I remember at the time that I didn't enjoy every moment. So looking forward to hearing your experience.
Yep. I'm excited, nervous, all the emotions around it. But it, you know, I've worked quite hard to get to this point, and I'm excited to have a chance to pass. Whether I do or not is yet to be seen, but at least, you know, I have an opportunity to take the exam. So I feel fortunate.
Well, I know you have all the skills and the mindset, so I'm sure it will be a positive experience. Should we talk about some news?
All right, let's talk about the news. What is what's happened in the last week or so since we've talked last?
Like you said, it's March 21st, and you know, the first story, I think the biggest story of the week is a sad one, a tragic one, and that's that David Breerscheers died at the age of 68. And you know, for me, who David Breerscheers was, it was just a household name for me growing up, dreaming of Mount Everest and the Himalaya kind of in the 90s. And he was legendary not only as a climber of the biggest mountains in the world, but also as a filmmaker from those mountains. And, you know, having worked on a lot of film projects now in the Himalaya and on Mount Everest, I know that the filmers are some of the greatest talent out there in terms of their ability to carry huge cameras, keep up with the athletes, or even be ahead of the athletes in order to capture the shots they need. So they needed to be so strong, and they also needed to have like the mental and emotional power to have like the creativity it takes to capture a story in the hardest places to do so on the planet. And Breer Shears was one of the originals. Probably what he's best known for is he was the filmmaker for the IMAX film on Everest that was filmed in 1996 when the Into Thin Air tragedy happened. And the IMAX film came out in 1998. It was the first IMAX film I ever watched. And it was absolutely a huge part of creating this dream that I had that led to this life. So it's a huge loss. I spent a bunch of time when I heard the news just reading sort of Instagram and people's tributes to him and the lives he touched, like Ed Beasters and Jimmy Chin and Conrad Anker and so many others. A legendary figure in this world.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was born in the 90s, and so it was a name. Oh,
this is like a stab to the heart.
It was a name that I was familiar with. And, I now want to go back. I'm fairly certain I saw the Everest film in theaters, the IMAX film in theaters. But that would, 98 would have made me 6 years old. So I have a hard time believing that I saw it at age six. But certainly, my family has a little bit of a connection to the Himalaya. And I remember hearing a lot about Mount Everest and the Khumbu as a young kid. And who knows if I saw that film at age six or a little bit later, but certainly I knew the name. And he impacted a lot of people in a time when Everest was it held a different place than it does now. It was much more raw, much more remote, challenging and complex than it is today. And I know you've seen change on the mountain, but at that time, it was a different mountain. It was a different accomplishment to climb Everest in the 90s than it is now. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would certainly agree. It's I still think it's an incredible accomplishment and a place where to this day, the reason I still go back 13 years on the mountain now, this will be my 13th year, is because every single person I've shared that mountain with, whether a Sherpa or a mountain guide or a professional athlete or a client, I've seen changed in some way by that mountain. And for each person, it's different and the experiences are different, but I've never seen someone not pushed emotionally, physically, and mentally by what happens up there. And that's still true today as it was in the 90s. So I think that's important to know. At the same time, yes, like the early stories from my friends that were climbing and attempting to commercialize the mountain in the 90s, like the risks were so high that we're not yet understanding about weather forecasting, the importance of communications amongst all members, or rope fixing like an umbilical cord for when the shit truly hits the fan up high. And so, yeah, the mountain has been transformed over the past two decades. We obviously hear a lot about that, and this podcast will talk a lot about that. There are positives and negatives, but one thing is absolutely true, which is the mountain is remarkably safer today than it was 30 years ago. And I believe, in the 90s, the fatality rate was still somewhere in like the 8-12% range. So imagine if there were 100 people on the mountain and 8-12% weren't going to come home. Like sitting at meals at the base, thinking about that. It's hard for me to imagine. I didn't go to the mountain for the first time, even though I started traveling to Nepal in the 90s. I didn't go to Everest until 2008. And the decade that these people had already put into making the mountain safer had already happened. So yeah. And overall, just, my thoughts and, best wishes to David's family and the people who loved him and who are going to feel this loss so much more deeply than us, to who he was just really like a figure we looked up to. It's a real loss.
Yeah. Other news that we discussed, there was a helicopter crash, a rescue helicopter on the Monte Rosa Glacier. You know, we talked a little bit last week about a tragic accident in the Alps, where five or six skiers were, on the haute route. And it just kind of, this helicopter crash highlights the risks of relying on, you know, rescue as a means of making your travel safer. In Europe, there's helicopters buzzing everywhere. There's a lot more helicopter activity, and it brings it back a little bit to, you know, when you are relying on the potential for, you know, helicopter rescue, you're also potentially putting other people at risk.
Yeah, I was so happy when you threw this story in our thread to check out, possibly talk about, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the story was, you know, we read it first on Explorer's Web. Angela Benavides, who does a lot of writing for the outdoor industry and really captures news first, she's where I saw this story first. So nice job, Angela. And reasons I love this story: number one, everyone survived. To have a helicopter crash with a helicopter, the photos, it's in pieces across a glacier, and everyone walked away. And not only that,
they proceeded to rescue the individual that fell in the crevasse that they were going to rescue in the first place. So they fly out to rescue someone, their helicopter crashes, and then what do? They rescue that individual from the crevasse.
Kudos to the Italians, the Italian rescue crew that was on that. I hope we hear more of this story. It might make a great short film. But yeah, they went ahead. They did the rescue of the climber in the crevasse. Another helicopter came from Air Zermatt, so from the Swiss side, to rescue the Italian crew of rescuers who had just rescued the climber in the crevasse. And what a great happy ending and a great story. But yeah, it does. It really ties into what we were talking about last week in the news about, like, how we utilize these helicopters and the fact that they are adding so much safety to the mountains. But I think we should never forget, in the same way that climbing mountains will always be dangerous, flying helicopters in the mountains is really dangerous. And so as we rely on these tools more and more and more, I do think we have to remember the potential costs of accidents amongst those rescue teams that we're putting at risk by needing rescue. That doesn't mean I don't think they should exist. And I know the vast majority of rescuers and heli pilots I know who work for the mountains love their jobs, and they want more rescues, not less, right? Because they just love flying around and doing these, like, super heroic things. But there is a potential cost there. The other interesting thing that I pulled out of this story, you know, was the altitude. We don't know the cause of the crash yet, but it was at the highest mountain hut in Europe at over 4,500 meters, or let me do the math real quick. Let's say 15-ish thousand feet.
Yeah, right about there.
and so what it immediately made me think of is our dependence of helicopters in the Himalaya and the incredible things that are happening there, where rescues are now happening in Nepal and Pakistan at as high as 23,000 feet, with things like the doors taken off and running less than 10% of fuel in the helis, and only one pilot instead of two, and no rescue crew. So the heli pilot is the rescue crew as well as the pilot. And it is the bleeding edge of helicopter usage. And I think there's a lot of risk to that. There's a lot of heroic stories to that. There's also a lot that the world of aviation is learning from flying helis and doing rescues at those extreme altitudes. And it's a fascinating world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think about pushing the limits of climbing, mountaineering. Topo talks a little bit about luck and how that plays into it in his interview that's coming up next. And certainly when you're rescuing at those altitudes, there's a bit of luck or just kind of slim margins involved. So
absolutely. I guess that maybe brings us to our last story. If we want to touch on it quickly, do we have time, Sam?
Yeah, let's do it real quick. You got 30 seconds.
He's not giving me signals yet. Like, cut it off. That's why you got to watch the video for these. Our podcasts are on YouTube as well. If you enjoy seeing Sam telling me to cut it out with hand signals. last story is just that the Everest season is actually beginning. So in the past couple of weeks in early March, we saw Sherpa teams beginning to go to base camp on the south side of the mountain, claiming their areas for what's expected to be the busiest season ever on the mountain. And now we're starting to see social media. If you follow things like hashtag Everest24, I do because I'm an Everest nerd. You can start to see the stories of clients, members, and mountain guides beginning to approach the south side of Mount Everest. The season traditionally, without pre-acclimatization or any of the new techniques that Alpenglow Expeditions uses, you know, it's a 2+ month long trip, and that means it starts in early to mid-March. Alpenglow's trip still is a month away, I'm happy to say, because I love home in April. And also, we climbed from the Tibetan side, and I guess that's the other part of the potential news. We're hearing rumors, and that's a lot of how the Chinese side of the mountain works, is rumors that while we were hoping for our Sherpa to cross the border around April 8th to begin setting up base camp, we're hearing rumors that the border to Tibet from Nepal might not open until as late as the 20th of April, which does put some pressure on north side teams. So first year going back to the north side in 5 years, it's going to have hiccups, of course. And I think this is the first one we're seeing, late entry.
Well, we're going to have a lot of Everest talk coming up over the next few weeks and into the actual season of the climbing season on Everest, but already shaping up to be an exciting one. So stay tuned. We've got our episode with Topo Mena and Adrian Ballinger, because Sam Kiekeffer had technical issues, coming up next.
It was a good one.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Alpenglow Expeditions, a Tahoe-based guide company with an international reputation. In its 20th year of operations, Alpenglow leads the highest quality expeditions in some of the world's greatest mountain ranges, from California's High Sierra to the rugged Himalaya. Alpenglow runs more than 40 international expeditions per year, as well as offering a full menu of guided ski and climbing courses throughout California. Join us and experience the Alpenglow difference.
Well, welcome back to the Duffel Shuffle podcast. I'm so excited to be here again, and this time with Topo Esteban Mena. Topo, thanks for joining us. Before you dive in, I'm going to give everyone just a quick intro of, who is Topo, according to Adrian Ballinger? I mean, this is actually hard for me. I think it's easier. Actually, I think it will be easier when we have guests I feel slightly less close to. We've done Emily Harrington's, like, how do I introduce my wife? And now we have Topo, who, you know, for listeners that don't know, Topo has been one of my closest friends, guiding partners around the world, and a huge part of my success on mountains like Everest and K2 on personal attempts that I've had. So just one of my very closest friends. And unbelievable mountain guide and alpinist, with some real powerful successes, in his past. So we might get into a little bit how I first, you know, got introduced to Topo, but kind of like big highlights. I'm looking at his website right now. He was the youngest non-Sherpa to summit Mount Everest without supplemental oxygen or support at 23 years old. And to put that in perspective, like, I'm really proud of my career. I didn't even go to Everest for the first time until I was 31. And I didn't summit without supplemental oxygen until my, I think like mid-40s, early 40s. So, like, just to do that at 23 is completely unreal. You've climbed the south face of Aconcagua, a route that I've always dreamt of, multiple grade 6 first ascents in the Himalaya, and all the while being, you know, perhaps the top rated international guide on the Alpenglow Expeditions roster. Like, every time a client climbs with you, they're like, I never want to climb with Adrian again. Like, let's get out there with Topo. So that's my introduction of you, Topo, but thanks so much for being here with us.
Oh my God, AB, thank you so much for your kind words. I'm like, shit, you know, am I blushing? Like,
deserve all of it.
Thank you for your love, and thank you guys for, you know, having me here, and hopefully, you know, talking about mountains and all these things that we love. And yeah, I mean, I've been pretty lucky in the big mountains for pretty much the entirety of my career, meeting amazing people like you that, you know, taught me a lot, like Carla, like Ivan Vallejo, like many others who thankfully, or I mean, I was just super, super lucky to meet a bunch of people that took me under their wings, and I was able to do a lot of things. So thank you very much, AP.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe this isn't exactly the order we were thinking of talking about things, but that kind of leads into one of the big topics that I wanted to talk to you about today, which is, like, can you tell us a little bit about how you got into high altitude climbing, mountaineering, and becoming a mountain guide? You know, you've already mentioned Kala and Ivan. Sam, welcome back. We're going completely off script, and we're starting with kind of like at the beginning, because Topo just mentioned a little bit about like Ivan, Kala, and really this topic of mentorship I find fascinating right now, like how you and I had opportunities in these sports, how we got brought in, and then how that still continues today, how we are trying to give new climbers opportunities out there. So can you give us a little background about how you got started so young?
Yes. So, I mean, for me, it really was almost like a coincidence that I started climbing. You know, you always read about these amazing stories of people that, you know, dreamt about the big mountains and the summits and was immersed in the climbing culture from a very young age, maybe the family. But it was not my case, definitely. When I was in high school, I was like, you know, totally problem child, super angry, super against everything and everyone. And, you know, that came, of course, from situations in life, from society, whatever. I mean, I'm not here to blame anyone for like why I was angry at like 13. Maybe everyone is angry at that age. Mm-hmm. But in my case, that led to a series of really bad decisions that eventually put me in a circumstance where I was just about to be kicked out of high school. And I was extremely, extremely lucky that at the time, the director of this high school in Quito, I'm from Quito, Ecuador, the director from this high school was into climbing. And he, when a professor took me to his office, and he's like, hey, we found this little punk, like almost drunk and like making problems, like things that I'm absolutely ashamed of today.
Sam and I both have very young boy sons, and I think right now both of us are thinking like, oh my god, is this gonna happen to us when our kid's 13? But absolutely. It's a good sign, it all worked out.
But at the time it seemed cool, you know, like to be that problematic boy. But anyways, the thing that this Spanish priest saw in me was like, okay, you know, if we wanna wash all this anger out of this guy, solution is climbing. So he made me go climbing like every weekend. I had to sign up in the climbing club that the high school had, mm-hmm. and that was not enough. Of course, I had to go every weekend to every climb or hike or outing they did, and if there wasn't any activity scheduled, I had to program one. So I was like, what? You know, are you kidding me? Like, you're like, this is like the worst, right? In my mind, I thought, okay, this is going to be awesome. Like, now finally I'm leaving this with, you know, like a jail, and I'm going to just finally go pursue my dreams of becoming a chef and like just having like that life or whatever.
Yeah.
And instead of that, I had to go climb every weekend. And little by little, I just started to see, you know, the beauty of the mountains, you know, and that changed my life, right?
That, even though you lived in this incredible mountain country, like, was it just not something you even thought about, going to these high mountains?
Again, I'm almost like ashamed of saying this, but like Cotopaxi, like these places that now mean so much for me, at the time, they weren't in my radar. You know, my life was Quito and like, you know, the city and everything that was around me. I had too many bad things to focus on So I didn't focus on the beautiful things, right? I did,
sure.
As it happens in life, I guess, right? So
yep.
I just didn't, I wasn't aware of like even Ruku Pichincha, which is a mountain that I love. And now I'm like, I want to go training. Of course, I'm going to go up. Ruku is like, this is my playground. But at the time, no, I wasn't, I didn't know nature, right?
Yeah.
And I started to go out to the mountains. In the beginning, it sucked. I think it took more, maybe not more effort, but like I reached the summit of my first mountain in a worse condition than I reached the summit of Everest the first time without oxygen and like, you know, like trying to do the best I could, right? Like
yeah.
When I was 14 and I climbed this mountain called El Corazon, is a 4,800 meter peak, like a 15,000 feet mountain.
Yeah.
I got to the top vomiting and like just hallucinating and like bad.
There must be something really wrong with us, because I know you know this story, but that's also my first high altitude experience was Cotopaxi, actually, and I was 17 years old. I was with a bunch of old dudes, and I thought I was a really good athlete, so I didn't listen to any of the recommendations about altitude. Ended up on the summit, vomiting, with full hallucinations. Like, I was asking everyone why they had built condominiums on the summit of the mountain, and I swear there were condominiums up there, like houses on the top of Cotopaxi. Ended up needing to be fully like short roped and guided down the mountain, puking, vomiting, blood, the whole thing. And like, you know, I got to the bottom, I was like, I am never doing that again. And then about 48 hours later in Otavalo, I was like, oh my gosh, that's like, all I ever want to do for the rest of my life. Like, so there must be something about that, like suffering, succeeding even with extreme pain, that caught you.
I mean, definitely in the beginning, it was like just something wakes up in you, right? I'm sure you two guys can talk to this, like, there's something, you know, when you go through hardship, like whatever this hardship is, there are some things that are left in you. I don't know if it's like your DNA or like whatever, right? Something is left in you. But these things happen to you. And then there's that, like, so like this monster that wakes up in you and you're like, oh my God, now it's like different. Like you kind of like, you just changed, right? And that, like, same as it happened to you, and I'm sure it happened to you, Sam, at some point, like the same thing happened to me, and I just started to, I mean, of course I was, it was an obligation for me. I hated it, and I was like, I don't want to do this again, but I had to go next weekend and next weekend. And for me, actually, everything changed. When I was 16, I went for the first time to Peru. I didn't even go climbing. I went, supporting some friends that wanted to climb a mountain called Pirámide de Garcilaso, like a technical climb. But, you know, in this structure that the climbing club had, I wasn't qualified for climbing internationally. Mm. First, I had to prove that I had the skills to survive an international expedition, right? Like, that's how they taught things to me. Like, yeah, someday you will be able to climb, but first you need to prove that you will be able to take the good choices and like survive, really. And like,
they just wanted someone to come and make coffee in base camp for them. That's ideal.
Yeah. Now when I think back on that, I'm like, those, you know, bastards, they just brought like a couple teenagers to make them coffee and like, you know, bring their crampons up to high camp. But I'm sure, like most people who has visited the Cordillera Blanca, for me, that was the first time that I saw these impossible mountains. You know, the mountains in Ecuador are beautiful, and I discovered beauty, like the beauty of the nature here in Ecuador. But for me, that was the first time looking at something and being like, oh my God, that's impossible. There's no way, like no one's able to climb that. And then you go to the, you know the Café Andino, Adrian, in Guaraz?
Very well.
Right? And then
Chris Bentway's coffee shop.
Right? And then you go to these places and you're like, Jesus Christ, like Arita Monasterio, Pavel Koshek, like all these legends, they are here like drinking coffee, drinking beer, and they actually climbed that thing that seems impossible. Like, you know, as a teenager, I was like, excuse me, sir? Can I get a photo with you? Like, you know, this was before social media or everything. So it's like, how did you do that? You know?
Yeah.
And these guys are like, well, you know, like you just gotta be tough and like, you know, that kind of hardcore climbers, like almost like fuck off, little boy, and then you're more hooked because that makes them seem more rad. And from that on, I was like, you know, I will just never stop. Like this is it, doing it forever.
So let's fast forward a little bit. Yeah, so you have this experience, you're seeing these incredible mountains, you're starting to get to go to different countries in South America. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned an experience where the climbers are sort of like, ah, get away, kid. But obviously that's not what happened throughout, because you met Yvonne, or somehow you connected with Yvonne and you ended up in the Himalaya. Is that right? So yes. How did that happen? So
that was... I mean, a couple years fast forward from that time, like meeting, you know, these like superstars of alpinism, right? In Huaraz, I was like, okay, if I want to do this for the rest of my life, I mean, how this is gonna be possible? So then, becoming a mountain guide became like the solution I found. Like I will share, I will teach, I will help others to discover this thing that I mean I don't suck at this. I have learned a couple things, and I can share this to others. I can help others, you know, accomplishing their things. And yes, that's gonna help me to pursue my personal dreams, like that other part of this passion, like my own dreams. And at some point when I was 19, I went with two of, you know, my very best friends, and you know, one of them is my life partner, Carla Perez, and Joshua Jarrin, to Aconcagua to climb the South Face. We climbed that in, like, you know, now when I think on that, it's like, oh my God. Like, sometimes I meet 19-year-olds and I'm like, what the hell my mother was thinking, you know, when she let me go. Of course, I mean, it's kind of like true story, but I mean, when she never knew that I was going to the South Face, I just told her, I'm going to Aconcagua, like, you know, go with some friends. And then when I came back, there was a little bit of like recognition in the media in Ecuador, because it's like one of the biggest faces in the world. And she's like, you did what? Like, you climbed, like, what? And
So we should just pause for 1 second for listeners. So Aconcagua is this, you know, one of the seven summits, one of the tallest peak on each of the seven continents. It's Aconcagua is the tallest peak in South America. It's in Argentina, 23,000 feet tall, approximately 7,000 meters. And the normal route on it is basically a hike. It could be done in sneakers in some seasons, even though we don't do it that way generally. It's a bit cold for that. It's a mountain we love guiding and have both probably spent a lot of time on. But the south face of Aconcagua was really this like proving ground for South American alpinists and really alpinists around the world. I'm probably going to exaggerate, but I'm going to say it's like a 2,000 meter or so face of just frozen mud.
It's 2,800 meter, like about 8,000 feet. Yeah.
And it's known for, it's of course not vertical, but it's consistently steep, snow, ice, and what I never did climb it, and now I don't think I would climb it, but I dreamt of it and looked at the routes for a long time, and they seem like they're basically like frozen mud and constantly falling down around you, and it's really hard to get protection. So you have to have just incredible faith, not only in your own skills, but also in your partner's skills. And is that a decent description, Topo? Was it a proving ground for you?
You did a pretty accurate, like, objective description of things, AB. Thank you.
Absolutely. But really a very proud, it's still to this day when it's climbed, it's like you said, it's notable. And much more so 20 years ago when you were doing it. It's kind of on people's radar when it gets climbed.
So, I mean, it was like a combination of things. The year before, we climbed this Iván Vallejo, which is one of the, you know, most notable recognized climbers in Ecuador and probably in South America, and I mean in the world.
Like,
he was the seventh person to climb all 14,000 meter peaks without the help of supplemental oxygen, and he was meeting all these, you know, he was like a part of an era, right? Like this time of people who were exploring, you know, for the first time in some countries, what it is like to be in the big mountains, right? Like, he was the first Ecuadorian to climb Everest, the first Ecuadorian to do like all those mountains, and coming back to Ecuador and telling these crazy stories about all this stuff, right? He had finished the year before his project, and one day he opened a climbing magazine in Ecuador and he saw like, what, these guys climbed like the south face and they are like, you know, one of them is like 19 and the others are like 25 and 22. Like, I want to climb with these guys. That's what he thought, thankfully.
Wow.
And
wow.
That started a partnership that lasted for about 10 years. I mean, of course, we're really good friends to this day. But at some point, as you know, like most things in life, you know, things change, evolve, and people start to take different paths. And we had an amazing partnership, and he is the one that took us under his wing. And he was like, okay, guys, now that you certainly have proved that, you know, you can do some hard-ish things or hard things, I'm going to teach you what I learned from others, because that was his philosophy, like sharing, you know, like the knowledge. So this fire doesn't end with one person, and it continues on generations, right? With other people. And eventually you get to see the amazing climbs, like the things that we see today in the magazines, but that is always the result of a process, right? So he had this in mind when he finished his project, and he basically called us and he said, hey guys, boys and Carlita, you know, we like, I now, by that time he had recognition in Ecuador. He had financial support from sponsors, which to this day, you know, is really complicated in general in the climbing world, but more in Ecuador, in a culture where climbing is not as notorious as probably soccer or, you know, other sports or like fighting or whatever. And he taught us, you know, and he took us in this wild ride of climbing 7,000 meter peaks, following a process, following what he learned from others, eventually climbing our first 8,000 meter peak, going to Everest with his mentality of style is super important, you know, like no oxygen, but that also means no shit shows. You know, it's not enough. It's not enough with like no supplemental oxygen. Like, you guys have to do it good. You guys have to like be good enough so no one's gonna come like, you know, save your asses because you were just pursuing like ambition and forgot about the basics. So
don't suck
kind of. So yeah, I mean it was like,
what was the 8,000 meter peak you climbed before Everest?
This you're gonna laugh about this, but my first 8,000 meter peak was Manaslu. That was Ivan's vision of like, this is how you're gonna enter the 8,000 meter peak realm.
No, I mean, let me think real quick. It was not my first 8,000 meter peak. It was close to my first too. I mean, it makes sense, even though it's not a peak either of us guide today. It makes a lot of sense.
I mean, for people listening, like Manaslu is an 8,000 meter peak that is among the lowest in altitude. You know, it's probably the 10th or the 8th, I think. It's you're not exposed as such crazy altitudes like Everest or K2, but the objective hazards in that mountain are like crazy. It's a mountain where, you know, you can see a lot of bad things happening. And that's what happened to us in 2012, where like there was a tragedy that killed 13 people. And we got to see all that and like just kind of have like this, you know, masterclass of like how to face tragedy, how to overcome these situations. And yeah, I mean, Ivan was truly like the one that took us on all these circumstances, going to all our first 7,000 meter peaks, getting lost, almost, you know, being really close to like bad situations, and eventually going forward. So yeah.
Well, I think this experience you were talking about, I mean, it's so funny. There's so many stories like I want to dive into, but that's why we hang out at base camp. So I can hear more and more stories to talk about it, but it is interesting. Like, you know, what you're describing is exactly what I think I and we still focus on today with our clients, is like gaining experience through time on mountains, not necessarily the mountain of your ultimate dream that you think is the final thing you want to climb, but spending enough time not only to learn how crampons work and how ropes work and, you know, what to eat and how oxygen works, but it's like for enough things to go wrong to understand how a team works through them, to understand what the focus of a team should be, like getting down alive, everyone getting down alive, preferably without frostbite. And also, like, I think failing in the mountains is like one of the key experiences that I want to hear about. I just had a call with a potential Everest client for 2025. And like, he's telling me all about his resume and his successes. And I'm like, all right, now tell me about a failure. Like, tell me about one where it all went wrong and it worked out. And, you know, I'm not trying to quiz people like, what did you learn? You know, but like, when I hear someone's failed on a big mountain and, you know, he had failed on Denali pretty spectacularly after like 5 nights at 17 camp waiting for a window, like that's where I think so much experience comes.
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of one of the main topics in climbing. Right. And I mean, personally, and I know you too, AB and Sam, that is the conversations we are really interested about, right? Like beyond the summits, beyond, you know, the highlights, right? Like what are the hard situations you had to overcome? Like, this is the conversation I'm interested in, because that's when we start growing, right? Like when we have all these, you know, I forgot this, I, you know, told this person that, I changed my job, whatever, right? Not just climbing, but life, I guess, right? And how you did that. Because at the end, it's like, like when things go well, of course, it's amazing. It's a great feeling. And that's like people say, that's what dreams are made of. But the thing is, like, we cannot be dreaming all the time, right? It's like a lot of life goes out of, you know, dreaming. And that's when you have to work hard, right?
Absolutely. And so just to sort of close the subject, Yvonne, you know, I have this like really... I remember Yvonne from my starting to go to Nepal from the late 90s, early 2000s, and hanging out in Kathmandu after running my trek on my 6,000 meter peak trip that I was so proud of to like Island Peak or Mara Peak, and then hanging out at like the steakhouse is where I met him for the first time. And I remember sitting with my team of Americans who were all very serious, and the South Americans in Spanish looked like they were having a lot more fun. But I just remember Yvonne, like, he was a legend. He had either just finished or was about to finish his 14, and he was still so open to like meeting me and like welcoming me into this community that I barely even started being a part of yet. So I have this great personal memory as well. But I wanted to ask you, like, if people are interested in learning more about Yvonne, does he have a film or anything like that out there that's like a good way to hear his story?
I mean, of course he has a website, like www.ivanvallejo.com. I mean, you can search him on Google, but there's a film he recently released called Behind the Fog. That is it's a little bit of a recap of his ideas and, you know, the things that led him to climbing Everest, because that was kind of his one of these experiences that changed his life and of course changed like climbing in Ecuador, right? Like when this guy went for the first time to Everest, the highest mountain in the world, like this Ecuadorian, are you serious? Like, is it also possible that an Ecuadorian can do these things? This is not just for like someone from New Zealand or someone from the US, like also someone from Ecuador can do this stuff. Like overcoming all these hardships that are different because you also have to, you know, find the sponsorship and like teach people, like educate like people around you about what you are just about to do, right? Things that he also got from his mentors, people that, you know, the first Ecuadorian that went to climb an 8,000 meter peak was in 1987, Ramiro Navarrete. He climbed Xipangma. He died the following year in a mountain called Annapurna. They just climbed a new route with, like, he was part of a team led by Kukuchka, like one of these legends we only read in books. But it's like, really, there's an Ecuadorian who's like on Kukuchka's team?
Amazing.
And, I mean, unfortunately, he died. But then he passed this to Yvonne. And then Ivan took this thing, and the film talks a little bit about this, like his path. So Behind the Fog, I think it's only
Behind the Fog. All right.
It was recently released. It's probably only on in Ecuador, at least only on the theaters. But I think internationally you can watch it. And yeah, it's a pretty good watch. All right. I highly
recommend
it.
If we can find a link to it, we'll throw it in the show notes. That's awesome. Behind the Fog. Well, before we move on, Sam, it looks like you're having a great time with technical issues. How's it going?
I have no idea. I think I'm back, although really I have no idea what is going on.
Expedition Live, Tom.
I know. You'd swear he's in like fucking Everest base camp right now. It's like you're gonna have to stable internet for when I go away.
Oh man, yeah, I don't know. I could be recording, I could not be recording. It really is unclear to me. But I've been listening, so thanks for leading the charge, Adrian.
Absolutely. I'm having fun, of course, but it would be great to get your voice in there. So there's so many more things I want to talk about, but what do you got, Sam?
Well, I want to hear a little bit about Topo today, you know, like Topo, obviously it sounds like you've had a phenomenal kind of climb in your climbing world and how you've kind of grown as a climber. It's a really fascinating story. You have spent a lot of time in the Himalaya. You've also climbed, you know, at the 8,000 meter level, and you've also climbed a lot of 7,000 meter peaks, looking at more technical routes, first ascents. What kind of inspires you today? What is kind of where are you hoping to take your climbing?
Oof. Well, I mean, today it's quite interesting for me. Like 5 months ago, and I think to this day is 5.5 months ago, I had a pretty gnarly accident while paragliding in Quito. I was in between trips, just coming from having an amazing couple months climbing with friends in Europe and exploring a little bit of the air environment. You know, I'm an earth environment person for most of my adult life, like climbing mountains and loving the rock, the ice, like all these more like earthly, you know, if that's a word. That earthly like environments. And in the past few years, probably also because my knees started to get like a little bit worn, I was like, if I can fly off a summit, that would be pretty cool if I don't have to necessarily walk of everything I do. And I started loving, you know, paragliding. And 5.5 months ago, I just had this accident where I destroyed my right foot, and I also broke my vertebrae was like exploded. I needed to get like spinal fuse. It's a whole story on its own, like having these kind of near death experiences, going through surgeries, and like, you know, you have internal bleeding and like all these things that you sometimes only hear like in magazines, books, and all of a sudden it's happening to you and you're like, is this the end of this wild ride? Like really, am I just, you know, facing the possibility of never being able to climb again, walk again, like do all these things? So it's been a really interesting 5 months leading me today, you know, to like finally kind of seeing, you know, light at the other side of the tunnel, like, you know, walking again, climbing again, cycling and doing like,
and just to get to that point, how many bones were broken in your foot? How long were you in a wheelchair for, and how many surgeries have you had? Give us the meat of it.
Yeah, I had like my foot needed like a total reconstruction. I had like 17 fractures in my foot. Like it was like when I see the images, it's like crazy. Like I had like dislocations. I lost a couple of joints in my foot. The doctor, the surgeons that helped me, they, I don't know, they were aligned with like some, like with the stars, I guess. I only needed two surgeries. Like the foot reconstruction went pretty well. You know, when I was, before going to my first surgery, I told my doctor, like, I asked my doctor, hey, what is the worst outcome? You know, like, and I was hoping he would say, maybe you will be limping. Maybe you would like, you know, not be able to move like as much, whatever. And he's like, the worst outcome is you wake up tomorrow and you don't have a foot. Like, this is real.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is the moment you start, you know, it puts lots of things into perspective, right? Like what is really important and all these things like we like to talk about, right? Like, tell me about your failures. Tell me about the times you didn't reach the summit, but this is taken to like
a whole other
steroids.
Level.
It's like the same conversation, but taken to the to a couple of steps forward, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then for my spine, I mean, the same thing. They opened my back, took all the bone that was incrustated in my spinal cord. Thankfully, nothing was damaged permanently. I got my spine fused from L3 to my sacrum to S1. So it's like a pretty significant damage. I had like one of my vertebrae was like exploded, and another one was like kind of like partially damaged. But it's one of those things that it's not really, you know, 1 millimeter more, 1 millimeter less doesn't really matter. It's just like my spine surgeon told me, like, I have seen people with the same injury as you had, just paraplegic. Like, I just don't know how you're able to kind of move your legs again, but somehow it's happening, and it's the magic of life, and like, you just have to be grateful. And that puts you in, like, you know, coming from, I climbed Everest, I climbed these, like, new routes, like, all these things, to, it was pure luck, you know, that I have another opportunity. That kind of changes a little bit in your mind in terms of like the gratitude and, you know, how to overcome these difficulties, right? So to answer Sam's question, right now I'm just kind of living the present, motivated, of course, about climbing. You know, I'm like motivated by people, by like all these things that we love to talk about, like failures, big faces, like 8,000 meters, all these quote unquote like impossible things. But I guess these kind of experiences, every time they put you a little closer to the things that matter the most, you know, like like relationship with others, like, you know, the times that I was in base camp laughing about life and drinking coffee with Adrian and like, you know, just trying to just be good humans and like do our job. And like that at the end, that's, you know, when you leave, I had two surgeries, when you leave the surgeries and every, like, everything is just coming at you like a waterfall of events, like, holy shit, like, how did I end up in this situation? You know, like, in the beginning, why me? You know, this victim kind of mentality. And of course, you're thinking the bad things, like why I did this, like all the mistakes. That's, of course, the first part. But then is like all these good times, you know, like all those moments, like when we are in a beach in Ecuador, enjoying with friends and watching the sunset and like, yeah, just.
Hell yeah.
The important things in life, guys.
Well, so, you know, as you think about that, the gratitude you have and the important things, and you're coming out of, you know, some of the probably darkest days of recovery now, like, you know, you're starting to be able to do things you love again and things like that 6 months in, like, are you feeling the fire for climbing hard routes, new routes, big peaks? Like, is that coming back? Is that still part of the puzzle, or are you not sure yet?
You know, it's interesting because in the beginning, you know, being in such a dark moment, I didn't really think about climbing. And, you know, this, anyone who's ever been through like a shit show, you know, you think on the important things, you know, when you cannot wipe your ass or eat because, you know, you can really not lift your hands and move, like you need every, like you realize that you're a human, that if it wasn't for others in that hospital to keep you alive, you'd be dead, right? Then forget about climbing. It's like, just I need to, you know, like the world kind of, you know, goes down or goes very narrow to like the important things, like my friends, my family, like myself. I need to be healthy again, like those core kind of feelings or those core ideas of life, right? And then as you start getting better, of course, you know, climbing is part of my identity as a human being, and this pursuit of doing the hard things, doing the doing the impossible things, or at least attempting to get close to that idea of impossible, right? Yeah, now I'm actually in a, I'm very grateful to be in this moment of like, actually, you know, I have fought so hard to be standing on my foot again. I have fought so hard to do everything again, to like eat alone, to like be able to take a shower alone, to like, you know, every, like recently I did a vertical kilometer, like 1,000 vertical meters for the first time in like 5 months.
Hell yeah.
And every step was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. You know, so it's like a new way of like fire, you know. I'm in a way you feel like, oh my God, this is the time in the movie when the superhero realizes that he needed like a secret weapon and now he has it. I mean, I don't want to say that I'm a superhero, but I love...
You're
I
a superhero, Topo. I like love, that. We're going to make you a little suit, a little one-piece suit.
I love like the Avengers and all these like Marvel stuff, right? And everybody kind of gets the idea of like, you know, when the good guy goes through the bad shit, there's always that moment. And I mean, I guess that's been a good lesson of like thinking, you know, in like my own existence as if it was some sort of like what's the story you want to tell about your life? What's the thing that is going to stay after you are dead? You know, what's the thing that you live with others, with your friends, your family, like, you know, with other people. And that, you know, takes me to thinking like, okay, if my life was like a little short film, I'm in minute 10 now, hopefully, like I have learned, hopefully, like...
Wait, how long is the movie? Wait a minute.
You know, like, and yeah, like this is, it's been an immense opportunity, AB. Like, there has been like really hard moments of like, you know, feeling that you let people down and like you let yourself down and all this horrendous ideas that come to your mind when this stuff happens. But thankfully, you know, I had amazing friends, like, you know, starting from my family, my whole Alpenglow family, and then going to my whole like Black Diamond family, people who's been very supportive with me. And then just learning that, yeah, this is just like a really shitty situation that I can, thanks God, I can turn into an opportunity type situation, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I know you have had some dark days and can only imagine what you've been through, but I also, your optimism has shined through continuously that you know, this is a path. It seems like you believe this is a path almost like you needed to be on, and that there is certainly a silver lining or something that is going to make you, I don't want to say better, but you know, that you're going to continue along your life's path and this is part of it. Is that right?
That's right, but you know, that is kind of the I don't know, it's the paradox of life, you know, because you don't want bad things to happen to you. Yeah. You don't want to go break your body to learn all these things. It's like, oh my God, like what? You know, it's, I cannot do this every year to become a better human being.
please don't. Please, we can't handle that either.
It's like, this is not something I can replicate again and again. And because there is, you know, there's just so much luck involved, and there's so much pain, and not just physical pain, but like the emotional scars left in your friends, you know, the trust that you break from yourself, from others, like all these beautiful things that you create for such a long time, and then all of a sudden with bad decisions you just break. You cannot do this over and over. But so of course I'm like, it's a difficult point in being grateful, but also like learning like, oh my God, you know, I don't want to do this every time, like again. Hopefully this is not gonna happen to me. It's, I don't know, it's like,
for sure. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, like, then what to do? Just, you know, be the present moment and just try to be better for tomorrow, right? Like that's the only thing we can do, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we'll move forward from the accident in just 1 minute, but two questions you kind of brought up with what you just said, like, and I know people have been asking me this, knowing that I'm a good friend of yours. So number one, like, is paragliding finished for you, or is paragliding still something that you very much see as your part of your mountain you know, scenario picture. And then number two, you mentioned like bad decisions. Was your accident a consequence just of bad luck, or is there actually all the clear learnings in kind of your decision-making process of when your accident happened?
Yeah. These are great questions, AB. So first of all, definitely paragliding is not finished for me. You know, throughout my life, I have taken a lot of risk. And as mountain guides like you, like Sam, we take a lot of risk. Then the question is, if we want to do this for the long term, how we mitigate these risks so we can justify this life we have, right? So we can justify going to pursue our passion over and over. So, you know, we can come back and enjoy the important things like the dinner with friends, like the, you know, but at the same time, having these passions, that is the balance, right? So paragliding is not over. The thing that's probably over for me after this is like trusting in luck so much as I have done until like in certain parts of my life. You know, I told you that, like coming a little bit to the beginning of our conversation, I was very lucky in the beginning, like when I was 19, when I was 18, like and those years, I you know, sometimes I'm like, I was purely luck, you know, like a lucky person that I didn't kill myself before because I took lots of risk and I learned from the mountains. Paragliding was a new activity for me that, you know, I kind of took that climber's mentality into a different activity. I tried to kind of simulate my path that led me to a really high level in my climbing life, in my paragliding life, but that is just not possible because, you know, you just have to be rational that eventually, you know, the numbers are going to go bite you. That's just how it is. Like, it doesn't matter how good you are, numbers are going to bite you if you just keep going forward without including a rational into your, you know, process of doing things, right? So you know, it makes me think about the important things. Like I love the air, I love nature, I love, you know, these feelings, these emotions, these moments that I have when I'm in the air. So definitely I'm not leaving, you know, paragliding aside. I'm just leaving, you know, that part of me that took me to have those mistakes. And then going to your second question, which is kind of the natural progression of that, is like, yeah, when you're broken, when you are in those problems, at least in my experience, and this is one of the things that, you know, I'm kind of trying to process right now, but I kind of like the way this is going forward for me. Sometimes, yeah, in very, very, very special occasions, it is about luck. But at the end of the day, you always have the choice to stop, like not leave your home, to not take off that day, to not leave from base camp, to not do the thing that's going to put you in that difficult situation, right? And if you choose to do it, for me, it has to be a decision that went through a lot of filters, right? So like, you know, this possibility of losing your life doesn't meet reality, right? So all these filters are what help you avoiding that reality, right? Like you go to a mountain, you could die. That's a reality.
Yep.
What's keeping you from that, right? In my accident, the conditions were difficult. I wasn't experienced enough for the wing that I was flying. The day before, I tried to fly from Chimborazo, like the highest mountain in Ecuador, and I had my whole set adjusted for that flight. And the morning I flew, the next day, I wanted to try my new wing that I didn't really fly a lot. So I spent a lot of time in the takeoff, wasting time, you know. And there were lots of signals, a lot of filters that, to this day, in my climbing life, if this happens to me, of course I would recognize this, right? Like if I see someone in a base camp doing all these mistakes, I would be like, because I know the possibilities, I would go and tell these people, hey man, maybe you wanna think better about what you are just about to do. But in my paraglider life, I didn't face all those experiences yet, and I just wasn't able to see the realities, and I just didn't have enough skill to go through a very difficult moment, and I ended up in really, really dipshit trouble, which I wasn't able to solve, and eventually that ended in me just hitting the ground in a very, very difficult landing. You know, that of course if I was like as experienced as I am, like climbing 8,000 meters, it wouldn't happen to me, right?
Yep. But
I wasn't in paragliding, and that is that moment when, you know, it's like it just makes you humble, because at the end of the day, it's like, you know, we are only humans, we are not machines. That's the beauty of life. It's cruel, but it's also the beauty of life, that we have lots of things to learn. But I mean,
well, I appreciate your openness with speaking about it so much, and kind of like these learnings you're taking out of it. And it's interesting, like you bring it back to climbing and your experience in that, and now you have this newer thing. But like, I think it's also such an important process to have, that you're relearning decision making and risk management and mitigation, and how much is worth it in this kind of like newer sport for you. And that's not to say there is no more risk or no more learning that can happen in 8,000 meter peaks. Of course there is. But you're right that you have put, you know, the old 10,000 hour, you know, idea into this other activity, into climbing. And certainly I have as well. And it's still, every experience is new and different, but probably the learnings are a little bit more nuanced, a little bit smaller. But if I relate to what you're saying, I started flying planes a few years ago, probably at a similar time that you started, you know, paragliding. And it was very much because I wanted to have those feelings of being completely new again. And part of it is so joyful, right? Because every flight I take, I feel like I learn so much. My progression is so steep. But also, I can fully recognize that, like, with that lack of decades of experience, when shit gets serious, it gets serious really fast. We talk in aviation about getting behind the airplane, to where we're no longer making decisions ahead of things happening. We're just reacting to the things happening. And that feeling when I've put myself in that position where I'm getting behind and it's starting to go wrong and starting to like snowball a little bit, like there is so much potential learning there, but also this like outsized risk. And that's a realization that I'm trying to be really clear about, of where I am on that, like that risk graph. As I'm learning something new, I want it to be joyous and I want my learning to be huge. And at the same time, I don't want to depend on the luck anymore, that similar to you, I feel like I dealt with so much in the early years of my climbing. But now there's so much more depending on me and on us, right? And at least for me, that is a factor, like, you know, obviously having a kiddo, but also having a business and having a life partner and having a family. And like, I like that those things are now weighing in my calculations as I'm learning this new thing. And it's interesting to hear you talking about some of those similarities.
How do you think, Adrian, that you have kind of mitigated, or I mean, you have moved from that kind of like luck mentality? Like, how's been your process? Like, you know, did you find like something written? Like, do people talk about this in your flying environment? Mm. Like how have you faced this path in your aviation?
I mean, I think there is so much out there within aviation, just because we know, similar to like Sam's really deep in like the avalanche education world of mountain guiding. And if his internet is stable enough, maybe he could speak to it. But so in aviation, like a vast majority of accidents, like we're all constantly spending more money on our planes to get better engines or better avionics, like the equipment we use to like deal with weather and navigation and things like that. But the reality is the vast majority of accidents in aviation are pilot driven. They're pilot mistakes. They're human factors, usually having to do with trying to make a flight happen that we should have backed off on. Like either the weather wasn't going to align, or our skills weren't enough, or there was something wrong with the equipment and choosing to fly anyway because we needed to get somewhere, or we thought we could pull it off using our skills. And so within aviation, I think the key is just lots and lots of conversation about the role luck plays and the role human factors play. And, you know, while it's never going to be possible to mitigate risk completely, like being humble in the face of those things. And so I just spent a lot of time, actually, I spent a lot of time reading accident stories. I know people do that in climbing, and actually I haven't done that in a long time, like reading the American Alpine Journals, like accidents of North America. That's what I spend a lot of time doing in aviation, is reading accident reports. And one of the interesting things about aviation is millions of dollars are spent on every fatal accident to truly understand the causes. And they take years. So you're often reading reports from 3 years later, but they really break down how and why an accident happened. And I learned so much through that. So that's what I'm utilizing. And then obviously, yeah, just trying to stay humble about my skills, kind of coming from my climbing experience, right? Like if I still am so uncertain sometimes in the climbing world about like the right or wrong decision, I still am uncertain, right? There's still unknowns. There's still luck involved. And I've been at it for 30 years. Well, if I've been at flying for, you know, 5 years and I only get to do it, you know, a couple of times a week, I'm very, very aware of that. And yeah, humility.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Like all these things take you to one point where, yeah, of course you start, you bring into the mix this idea of, you know, being humble, accepting that, you know, we're all only humans. And like, at the end of the day, we have so much to learn about things that happen to us. But also this idea of, and it's been one of my takeouts, right, from my experience, like, there could be a lot of things that you could blame on for the bad things happening, but the responsibility of what's going to happen next, it depends only on you, right? It's like, mm-hmm. it's only about Adrian when you're in the plane, when you're like going to a summit attempt, when you are doing whatever you're doing. Like, you cannot blame anyone when you are in this, when you, I imagine like when you're sitting in the plane and like things are going wrong, it's like, that is not the moment to be like, because my parents did this to me, like, you know what I mean? That moment is like,
that is not the time.
It's not the time. You're like, I just have to do this beyond good and evil, you know. You just have to do, like, to do the best you can, right? And that really teaches you, like, it kind of changes the mentality of, like, when you share about these things, you know, lots, like a few friends that are very close to me, and they, you know, they came in my first days when I was, you know, like out of the surgery part of like my incident. And, you know, you can tell like people out of love, but out of also like, maybe respect, I don't know. But people is sometimes afraid of telling you, like, of asking you, like, hey, what happened to you? Because it's really common to be ashamed of, like, you know, I did this bad at whatever. But then you realize, like, okay, this happens to me. I don't want the same thing to happen to a lot of people. So, like, there's no reason for not, you know, sharing and talking about these things. Of course, like, you know, I would be ashamed if I don't know, man, if I went and did something like I went driving drunk. I mean, even if you do, like, driving drunk and doing some things, there's always like series of decisions that take you to those bad decisions that you can learn from, you know. Like, there's always that component of like, man, we can talk about this openly and like just hopefully this won't happen to others and this won't happen to me again, you know.
I think you are so right on. And I, you know, like, we're all fuck ups. We can all look at the horrible decisions we've made in life. And like, it's not like the next generation is going to avoid being fuck ups and making terrible decisions just because the old folks talked about their stories. But I do think an openness, an awareness, a willingness to talk about those things can help. Maybe it's avoiding the exact scenario that happened to you, but I think it's also just like helping, like, I think I didn't realize that as much as when I was young, that like all the old folks had just like fucking stumbling along as well and trying to figure it out as they go along and do the best they can. And so the more we talk about those things, I really do think like it just helps all of us, hopefully, on this path of being humans. So I appreciate all of this conversation. God, we could do it all day. But Sam, if Sam could be on the call right now, he'd be telling me to keep it moving along. These are meant to be tight episodes.
I'm back. I think I fixed my issues.
Fantastic. Are we talking about your personal issues or your technical issues?
All of the above.
Well, you're going to really enjoy listening to Topo's thoughts and learnings when you have the opportunity. Let's move forward from, you know, like, what is your 5.5 months in, you did a vertical case, you're walking uphill again. Like, what do the next few months look like recovery wise and then like, getting back to climbing?
Well, I mean, this for me, it's become a path of like, rediscovering the mountains, which also has been amazing in a way of like, you know, seeing things with new eyes. So I am, before I can go back to, you know, this place that, you know, makes my dreams, these like the 8,000 meter peaks, like these, these mountains that, you know, have been firing me up since, you know, a long time. Before I get back to that, I need to slowly start following the same process that I did when I was like a teenager. So for the next few months, just lots of PT. Like, I'm very fortunate, you know, that I have a team, like a pretty solid team with my physiotherapists and a coach and like people helping me to put everything together. My, you know, in the month of May, I'll be going again to like slowly climbing, like doing scrambles and like climbing like fourth, fifth class again in the mountains. Now I'm in the gym. I'm again, you know, like climbing like 5.11. So one of my first goals is like trying to climb 5.12. Like again,
yeah.
Like if it was like first time in life. And I guess from like a global perspective and responsibility and my job with Alpenglow Expeditions, in the summer I want to go guide Kilimanjaro, which is going to be like guiding Everest for me, you know, putting all these like things that, you know, I have learned and like all these ideas into, you know, climbing the highest mountain in Africa, which is not like really a technical climb, but for me personally, it's going to be a big thing in terms of, you know, coming back to that. You know, I'm a mountain guide. Of course, part of the things is like, it's not the thing of like, I want to come back to what I was before the accident, because you learn that life just continues forward. And there's, you know, what you were before, it doesn't exist anymore. Like that topo that existed 5 months ago, like it doesn't exist. Like it's my own responsibility to make it better or worse right now, right? So hopefully it's going to be worse when I go grab Kili. And then next year, going back to 8,000 meters and, you know, climbing some of the highest mountains in the planet, which is for me, just that magic number, you know, like that the magic that happens at that altitude where life cannot happen, you know, like that. I don't know. It's just it goes beyond words, and like probably you can explain it better, Adrian. Like all these things that we feel, that we see, that we live up there when we are at such extreme altitudes. That's what, you know, makes a lot of my passion for the mountains move forward. So that's, yeah, I guess 2025, just being back to climbing high mountains and yeah.
You. Well, the mountain guide community and the Alpenglow community and our clients and I are so excited to see that path and your return. You know, I think one of the interesting things is, you know, Alpenglow and I are returning to Mount Everest this spring for the first time in 4 years since actually almost 5 years, right? Like the north side of Mount Everest where we guide in Tibet has been closed for 4 years now, from 2020 until this year, 2024. So I was kind of doing the math and I was like, wait, that means the last time we were there was 2019. And that's basically 5 years ago. And it's a long time to have not been on that mountain, kind of striving, like you said, to be a team in the highest place on the planet where life is not meant to exist, and doing it as safely and ethically and hopefully funly, with the most fun as we possibly can. I'm making up words now. But it's a big deal for me to be going without you. I don't think I've actually guided that mountain or been on that mountain now for a whole bunch of years without us kind of doing it together and being the, like, you know, check on each other and the sounding board to go back and forth. And so it's something I've been thinking a lot about. We have an incredible team even without you, Topo, but it's going to be a very different experience. Oh. So I guess all that to say, I might be FaceTiming you from base camp a lot.
Thanks God we have internet, satellite internet these days. It's not the 1990s anymore. We can talk to all our friends from base camp.
Thank God. But yeah, maybe that's the last kind of, I mean, there were so many things that I would love to talk about today. We're just going to have you on again after Everest, but just give us the quick rundown of your decision. Like, how does it feel not going this spring? When it's very clear why you shouldn't go this spring. I think everyone understands that, but like, has that been an emotional roller coaster as well, knowing that we're going back and you won't be there?
Yeah. I mean, of course it's been like part of that thing of like, you know, when you create a team, everybody in the team becomes like such a valuable asset. Like everyone puts something into the team, like even if it's like a like an idea or like the person that helps others in the hard day making tea or whatever it is, right? Like everyone is an important component in our teams that are small enough to have this familiarity. So yeah, it's been hard. But that is also part of this concept of like, you know, we move forward. This is what we do. You know, we overcome adversities and like thinking on like, you know, would it be great to be there? Yeah, of course. But I mean, what Alpenglow needs and what I need and what like, you know, the world need is for you, for anyone like to be back to 100% so you can give your best. And that is part of what makes, I believe, and you know, why you and I connected so much, Adrian, since the first time we worked together climbing big mountains. Like, we need to be good at doing this thing. We need to be at our 100% so we can give the best to the people coming and trust in us, you know? Yeah. And that requires a lot of honesty. And of course, sometimes it sucks. Like when you have to be like, oh my God, I cannot do this year. Of course I could, but it wouldn't be the best for the team. It would be the best for me, but not the best for the team. Right. And that is, you know, when things start to go beyond just, you know, personal interest and, you know, these kind of like deeper ideas of, you know, what is life about, right? So for me personally, like it's been like, okay, you know, I won't be with you guys this year, but you know, I'm gonna give my best in the prep, like writing as much as I can about like what to buy, the snacks, like anything that I feel like I could give to the team, right? Like anything, even if it's just like cheering people up when they are going to the summit attempt, like just that kind of like energy. Yeah, of course. But it wasn't the best for me to go this year. And like, you know, of course the next time I'm back, I'll be able to give my 100%. And that is just what we do as professionals, right? Like take the hard decisions sometimes.
I think, such a good encapsulation. And it is interesting. It's like, it takes a lot to see that, right? Like what is best for the team and like what is 100%? Because you're right, you would be fine. If you went, you would be fine. But like I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, yesterday I was asked on Instagram, good old Instagram, like, do you ever guide not on supplemental oxygen? And I gave this like 5 minute like diatribe of what bullshit it is to guide a Casamita Peaks not on oxygen, but it in my opinion, and feel free to disagree with me, but like what it really came down to was like, would I or you be capable of guiding an 8,000 meter peak without supplemental oxygen? Probably, as long as like the day goes good. But the idea of having 100% for your clients, for your team, for your work, and not your personal desires, like none of us can claim who have climbed 8,000 meter peaks without supplemental oxygen, like, or I should just speak for myself. I'm not 100% when climbing without supplemental oxygen on the tallest mountains on the planet. And it's a small example, but it's the same idea, right? Is like, how can we as professionals do the absolute best job possible for our clients and for our team members, which includes our workers and coworkers and other guides as well. And, you know, it takes having a hard look at where we are in our lives, whether it's emotional baggage we're bringing in or a physical injury or personal desires, and how to make sure those things are like not helping us make poorer decisions in the mountains for our clients.
I mean, it's part of that kind of like, I don't know if I'm going to make up a word, hopefully not, like that integrity that you need in life, right? Like to like that beauty of living accordingly to what you feel, like living accordingly to your core values, right? Like, I'm not just talking about things like sometimes, of course, it's going to suck, you know, missing people and like not being there, like not doing this or not doing that. But the thing is like, how you can live accordingly to these values we love to talk about. Sometimes you need to take the decisions, and then one of these decisions probably is, I'm not ready this year to do this goal. But life is greater than just one thing. You know, life is like a crazy sequence of events happening. So it's like, maybe 1 year is not too bad. You know, 2 years is not too bad, but, you know, I'm going to be better. And that's part of like the same thing that sometimes we try to explain people, you know, like maybe this year you're not ready for climbing this, maybe come back next season. And there is, of course, sometimes that urgency of like, I want to do this, but the thing is not necessarily related to what you want. The thing is like what you really need, you know, what you really can, and what is real, you know. And that, like you say, AB, that takes a lot of like, it's hard sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you're doing it, and I'm looking forward to seeing the next steps along the path as you make those decisions and get back to the things you love. Sam, help us. Get us back on track.
Well, I mean,
otherwise, AB,
I know how long it's been. I know how long it's been because I've been dealing with technology. I don't know what you guys have talked about, but it does feel like we should wrap up this episode. So we're going to wrap up with two questions that we ask all of our guests on the Duffel Shuffle. First, Topo, we want to hear your best Duffel Shuffle story.
My best Duffel Shuffle story. I don't really have a best Duffel Shuffle story. Probably one of my last Duffel Shuffle stories that have been crazy was last year when I was packing up in Pakistan after we, with Alpenglow Expeditions, we guided, we successfully guided like Kashmir 1 and 2. And you end up, you know, day 34 of 35 days in the trip, and you're back in Skardu packing everything back to, you know, the States, and like everything is madness, and you have like a whole, you know, like, porters, cooks, you know, the team members, like everything, everyone is just asking like, hey, Topo, what this? What are like the tips, like the transportations, the cars, like, and everything is just chaos. And you're like overwhelmed by things. And then all of a sudden you are like, "Woo! I love this. This is just like amazing. Thanks life. I'm living this," because it's like that madness that makes, you know, life so interesting. So yeah, that was my craziest Duffel Shuffle, like, you know, trying to pack like all these dirty clothes and like all Alpenglow things, you know, like batteries and like oxygen, and there's always that one bottle of oxygen that's missing. And,
and we're still trying to find some of those things.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess it comes back to that madness that sometimes it feels overwhelming, but at the end of the day, that's part of the reason why I keep doing these things, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure that chaos is what draws us all to these adventures. And you know, you talk about that adventure, not about the summits, but everything else that makes, you know, that trip so memorable.
Yeah.
All right. So your next trip, you talked about maybe going to Kilimanjaro this summer, but for your next trip, what is one piece of gear that you're super excited to throw in your duffel? I know you've been spending a lot of time. You've got a new sponsor in Black Diamond. You've been spending a lot of time kind of tinkering with gear as you've been recovering from your injuries. What are you most excited about?
Oof. I mean, first of all, and I mean, thanks for bringing this up. Like, I'm super excited for this amazing opportunity of, you know, joining the Black Diamond team. I think beyond just being a climber, you know, like coming from Ecuador and like the climbing community here, it's, for me, it's mega, you know, to have this opportunity to join a team that, like this company that has been since its very beginning, you know, sharing the core values of climbing and, you know, like inspiring people. And they recently released this film, The Mentor. And I was like, oh my God, I love this. It's just so amazing. Like all these things I love to talk about.
Seriously.
It's like, I couldn't be prouder of, you know, having this platform of sharing ideas and, you know, building badass equipment. But you know, Black Diamond, I mean, it's like, yeah, of course, all of Black Diamond's things. But for my next adventure, and this is not a sponsored thing, actually, there's someone from this company. Like, I think three things that, like, Adrian's going to laugh at me because this is always, like, Topo's style. Like, of course, my green juice. Like, I cannot go to anywhere without my green juice, like Athletic Greens, like AG1 is just the shit. I'm not sponsored by them. Hopefully someday I will be, but like I love that stuff. My Kindle with all my things that I read and I like to keep learning and things. And my hangboard, right? Because I just need to keep my fingers strong. And, you know, I guess for me, that kind of circles back to that idea of like, I need to take care of myself first before I take care of others when I'm a mountain guide. So before I do a kick-ass job in the mountains, green juice, I need to, you know, I need to fuel my body. I need to fuel my brain. And I need to keep my fingers strong.
And then it goes back to being 100%, right? You have to be 100% to perform for your clients. And, you know, if you're not at 100%, then you can't do your job to the best of your ability.
Yeah.
I love that list. That was, even though I will choose not to agree with you about green juice, but that is just a fantastic list of, you know, taking care of yourself. And the cool thing about those things you mentioned is like, I bet they go in your duffel, whether you're going to the tallest mountain in the world, whether you're going to the beach for a weekend, or whether you're going to give a corporate talk or go design new gear in Salt Lake City at Black Diamond. Like these things just are like a base of being like the human you are and taking the best possible care of yourself that you possibly can to then give as much as you do. So, rad list.
Thank you, AB.
I like it. Well, as we continue on and wrap up, you know, we always like to ask people, obviously we touched on so many subjects today, and I think people are going to be really interested in learning more about you and following your journey as you return to the badassery that makes you you. So how could people follow you and find you?
I mean, like most things nowadays, Instagram is one of the best platforms. I feel it's amazing for me to share like this beauty of the mountains, like these images, these videos that I like to capture, and also some ideas about the experiences that we live on. So in Instagram at Esteban Topo Mena, that's a good way to, you know, get in touch with me, like ask questions. Like, you know, I'm like super stoked always about, you know, like when people's reaching out to ask, hey man, like how you do this, like what do you think about this or that, like I love that. So thank you, like to everyone who's ever reached to me, and like to everyone who would like to follow me in IG and in the grams, and yeah, like go with me in this journey. And my website, estebantopomena.com. And yeah, recently a lot of the Alpenglow's kick-ass blogs that we have been collaborating on, and trying to also share some ideas at Alpenglow's website.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Topo, for being willing to be one of our season one guests and being so open to the conversation. I loved it and can't wait to do this again in person at the base of a mountain soon.
Thank you, guys. I mean, I just want to say thank you to you too. And I wish you the best. This is like, I mean, I know it's going to be like a kick-ass podcast, and I'm, when you reach out to me, like, to see if, you know, we could do this together, I'm like, yeah, definitely we should do this, because I'm sure you two will help or will be means of, you know, spreading all these ideas, like, that we feel are important, like talking about the hardship, talking about the difficulties that we all face, and trying to be real. And I feel that's what, you know, makes these things so rich. So good luck.
You.
I loved it. And yeah, thank you to, from my side, to my family, Carla Perez, my kick-ass wife, who's been with me through all these moments, and especially to Black Diamond for being with me.
Hell yeah. Sam, I'm worried the same way Topo's replacing me as, you know, a mountain guide on the Alpenglow Expedition staff. He might replace me as a co-host on the Duffel Shuffle one day.
No. Come on.
I can say without a shadow of doubt, he will be back on the Duffel Shuffle in one way, shape, or form in the future.
Thanks for listening to episode 2 of the Duffel Shuffle with Topo Mena. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave us a review. Since recording this episode on March 21st, there have been a number of tragic accidents, including a handful out of the Alps. Our thoughts are with those affected by these accidents, and we'll be sure to talk about them more in episode 3, which will drop April 30th. And until then, we hope you enjoy some time outdoors.